This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to the Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. I'm Melissa Idris and I'm going to be with you for the next 4 hours. And also here, Julian Ng. Good morning, Jules.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning to all of you out there.
Did you have a good weekend? Ready to kick off the new week?
As ready as I can be because I had a busy weekend.
That
wasn't the nicest part of my weekend. But yeah, I appreciate any weekends that I can get.
Yeah. Well, you know, busy weekends doing errands and stuff, it's the only time you've got to do stuff. I try to perhaps pack as much as I can on the weekends so that I'm not worried about, you know, running errands and stuff on the weekdays.
It That's true. When you say pack as much, is that just doing errands or
chores?
Doing the real stuff like watching movies and catching up with friends?
You know, last week we spoke about how you watched Manchester by the Sea. You told me you watched Manchester by the Sea. And this weekend I tried to catch the best picture, the movie that won Best Picture, Moonlight.
Moonlight, yeah. No spoilers, please. I haven't seen it.
It reminded me of your feedback on Manchester by the Sea.
Oh, no,
as well.
That's as good as a spoiler.
Sorry, I had to tell you what I thought about it. As I was watching, I was like, wow, I should tell Julian.
Okay, that we got. I have to watch because that's best movie. Given that imbroglio with that award, definitely have to catch up with that.
With La La Land especially, right? Okay, well, hope you stay with us this morning because today on The Breakfast Grill, we've got Karin Mohsin-Lechner, ambassador of the Netherlands to Malaysia. Now, this is really quite interesting times for the Netherlands and our relationship with the Netherlands because recently when the Ministry of International Trade announced our trade numbers, it turns out that the Netherlands is one of the top three major foreign investors in Malaysia. I was surprised to learn that. And also, we're going to be asking the ambassador about the looming Dutch elections set to happen later this week and its impact on the rest of the European Union and global markets. Now, I have to tell you, Julian, that in normal times, nobody outside the Netherlands will probably take a lot of will take much interest in a Dutch election. But I think that this election is coming just as we're seeing a populist surge sweep across Europe and the US, not to mention. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this raised the question of whether the Netherlands will be the next domino to fall in this populist game.
That's right. What is going to happen this Wednesday, which is when their elections are going to take place, will have huge reverberations across Europe and across the world as well, because the firebrand there, and he goes with a name that's really hard to pronounce. I think it's Geert Wilders. Geert Wilders.
The English pronunciation, Geert Wilders.
Yeah. He is like the Donald Trump of the Netherlands, and he, according to the polls right now, is neck and neck with the ruling party prime minister. And that's very worrying for the Netherlands. Of course, he's anti-Islamic, anti-immigration. Also, there is a growing section of Dutch community that wants out of the EU. So could this be the next exit, right? Netherlands exiting the EU. And that's very relevant for all of us as well.
Right. Well, you know, when I think about the Netherlands, a couple of news items come to mind. The first one was right after the Donald Trump win, we saw the Netherlands put out this
video that went viral,
that went, you know, America first, but can the Netherlands be second?
And excellent video, by the way.
It was hilarious. The other news item that comes to mind was also, I'm not sure there's a video, but a full page ad that went viral on social media where Mark Rutte, the current prime minister and his party, took out a full page ad in some of the papers to basically say, to reject any migrant who had come into the country who will not, quote unquote, accept the country's values. So he's saying, act normal or go away. And, you know, it really kicked a discussion about what is normal? What are Dutch values, right? So this was, I believe, coming after a case about a migrant in the Netherlands who did not want to shake hands with women who were not his relatives. And he was applying for a job, I think, as a bus driver. And the court had ruled, well, you know, shaking hands with random strangers or random women, that's not part of your job description. So you can say you don't want to. But mm-hmm. the Dutch society had said, well, that's part of the assimilation of the Dutch culture.
Yeah, I think that apart from the latent xenophobia that exists, demagogues and all these right-wing populist politicians are also tapping into the disenfranchisement of the people. And I think that for a country, especially like the United States, where inequality has been growing to a level that's unprecedented, even though the stock markets and other financial assets are doing really well there, there is a whole bunch of people, not only in the United States, but around the world, that are very disenfranchised. Mm. And that is very fertile ground for politicians to tap into to gain popularity. And the sad thing about this is because they can't solve the inequality problem in the short term, because that would involve moving mountains, right? Especially when you talk about taxation of the rich. That is a huge political mountain to move. And in the short term, you wouldn't be able to redistribute efficiently to the poor. And therefore, people like, I think, Donald Trump and Geert Wilders in the Netherlands will tap into this and say, okay, you can't solve this in the short term. In the meantime, I can get some political power. And I think that, unfortunately, is what's happening.
Okay, well, we'll have to keep a close eye on this. Elections are on Thursday,
yeah.
Yep. So more on the relationship between the Netherlands and Malaysia. That's on the Breakfast Grill at 8 o'clock. But after that, at 8:30, we check in on the latest on the Football Association of Malaysia's elections for the post of president. Now, it's a two-horse race in the FAM presidential elections. You've got former Kelantan FA President Tan Sri Anwar Musa going head-to-head with the Crown Prince of Johor, Tengku Ismail Sultan Ibrahim. And, you know, this was initially slated for next year. But what happened was, I think there was such backlash over the lack of, I guess, there was a lot of corruption, mismanagement in local football.
Because Tan Sri Anwar went through that abuse of power investigation with the MACC as
That's
well.
Right.
And he has a political position within UMNO as well. So I think that this is really fascinating to me, because I never knew that so much attention can be given to the presidency of the FAM and such high-powered political figures participating and running for the election over there. To me, that's really fascinating for a football association.
Yeah, well, on one hand, we've got a political figure. On the other hand, we've got a royal figure. So which one is better suited to run this top football post? In fact, we're going to have a series on this. And this is today we're going to play the first of a two-part series. We will explore Tan Sri Anwar's candidacy today and his chances of winning the presidential post. Here is what football analyst Vijay Vic, we spoke to him, and here's what he thinks about Tan Sri Anwar Musa's chances.
At the same time, we've got to remember that he transformed Kelantan since he came on board in 2009. And for a short period of time, before the Moneybags JDT came in, Kelantan were the best team in the country, because a lot of things have changed. The money came in, today JDT are the number one team. Have they bought success? That's a different story. But before the inflation of salaries and all that, Kelantan were the best team. So you've got to give him some credit for that. And if he could apply that in FAM, then it's possible. But it goes back to, will everyone work together? That's what we need today. And as of now, things don't seem to be working together.
That was Vijay Vic, an analyst, a football analyst and commentator. He has a point. Perhaps Kelantan was doing very well under Tan Sri Anwar's
presidency.
Yeah. Yes. But now, whether you know this will split the Malaysian football scene into camps, right? So you've got the royal camp and the Musa camp. Whether, you know, everyone will work together. Vijay doesn't sound very optimistic there, but we'll have to see.
Which is going to be a pity, because sports, and especially football and badminton, we read news of Lee Chong Wei winning the All England.
That's
but,
right.
It can be such a galvanizing factor for the country. And if people can use this position to rally everybody together, then I think Malaysia can be a better place to be in.
So more on Malaysian football at 8:30. But you're absolutely right, Jules. Speaking about sports, some good news that Dato' Lee Chong Wei has beat China's Shi Yu Qi last night at the Barclays Card Arena in Birmingham, England. And he has claimed his fourth All England singles title. So he won the title in 2011, 2012, and 2014. And this year was a bit of a was in doubt because I think people had expected Lin Dan to make the final, so they were worried about Chong Wei going head to head with Lin Dan,
the arch rival.
That's right. So,
but there was an upset because Lin Dan unexpectedly lost to the finalist Shi Yu Qi in the semifinals.
That's right. So you know there was also talk about Chong Wei retiring. So yep. he's 35.
Grand
now.
Old age of 35.
He's not that old, I have to be completely honest with you. But in the world of sport, that's, you know, that's a senior citizen already, I guess. But he said he will see, he will be going to Glasgow for the World Championship 2017 and next year's All England. So
how come we don't have holiday today? Yeah?
But for, as in like a, we get a public holiday? I don't know. Yeah, we should, right?
Yeah,
maybe
I
not
think
for
so.
All. Not for all sports.
I mean, the last time that Lee Chong Wei won was in 2014. I mean, the two previous times, 2011, 2012. That seems like, not to downplay the achievements of you know, the great badminton player, but 2014 was some time back. Today's this year is 2017. We should get a public holiday for this.
You can make a request, Julia. It might be a bit late by
maybe
now.
Maybe Glasgow. We'll get 2 days in one at a go.
There you go. Unfortunately, our mixed doubles pair failed to cross their final hurdle. They lost to the pair from China. But let me tell you very quickly to round up our show of what's coming up on our show today on Pressing Matters at 9:30. That's, of course, the show that takes you beyond the headlines of the day. Today on the show, Washington, D.C.-based author and professor of journalism will be joining me, John Dinges. Now, John was also the former managing editor of NPR News. And what we want to discuss today, essentially, is the challenge faced by U.S. media in covering President Donald Trump. You know, as you know, I mean, this may be a brave new world for U.S. media, but for us journalists here in Malaysia, this is something we're all too familiar with, given our relationship with authorities here. It's often top-down and met with many roadblocks. Mm-hmm. But now the U.S. media, they're trying to deal with this hostility coming from the White House. If you remember, a while ago, Donald Trump, he himself called the media the opposition party. So he views the media as someone he has to battle against. We've got, you know, Sean Spicer, the press secretary at the White House, saying that the White House is planning to aggressively push back against the press. He did that by blocking a number of media outlets, including the New York Times, CNN, the BBC, and the Guardian, from attending the briefing. And, of course, Steve Bannon, a White House strategist, famously said that the media should just learn to keep its mouth shut.
How can we? I mean, this is what we do. Yeah, we go out there and talk.
But what happens if the White House blocks access to you for media organizations? So, for instance, blocking the New York Times and the Guardian from attending a press briefing is essentially saying, well, we're not going to entertain any of your questions. So we will select the people we want in the briefing and in that way curate the kind of questions we are getting at White House briefings, which is a dangerous and a chilling effect.
Totally.
I think, yeah.
And totally laughable as well. That because the Americans tout themselves as you know, the free world, the leader of the free world, and if you're a free world, you need press freedoms.
Right. There's also a debate that's going around among major media organizations about whether or not to call Trump's false statements lies. Now, I really personally find this debate fascinating because I think it's quite dangerous to use the L word, mm-hmm. so to speak.
But, why is that?
Because it's the job of the journalists not to be partisan, not to pass judgment. Mm-hmm. So you can say, well, Donald Trump's statements have been proven to be false, but you can't say Donald Trump is a liar because that's passing judgment, right? it's different from reporting versus commentary. And I think in commentary, if you want to call him a liar, that's fine. But that's your name calling Donald Trump a liar instead of the publication's name calling Donald Trump a liar.
I think it's a tough position to take, though, because if something you're calling something white that is black, it's clearly lying. So what do you do with that situation?
Well, the Wall Street Journal, they have said that they're not going to use the word lie. They say lie implies much more than just saying something that's false. It implies a deliberate intent to mislead. But on the other hand, the New York Times has taken the position to call a spade a spade. If you're lying, if you're telling an untruth, we will call you a liar and we will call them lies. But it's gotten some backlash amongst media observers as well as the reading public. So I'm going to ask John Dinges to weigh in on this debate and see what he thinks, given that he was former NPR news editor. These are the types of things that land on his desk often.
And it must be said that NPR is really highly respectable because they are totally neutral and non-partisan in their approach to news.
6:16 right now, after this, the BBC interview that went viral over the weekend and how it sparked debate about racism. Details after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Try a Little Tenderness by Otis Redding. Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run with me, Melissa Idris, as well as Julian Ng. 6:22 right now. And by now, I think most of you would have seen the video of a BBC interview being interrupted by two small children. It's gone viral on the internet. And I remember seeing it and just going, I was mesmerized by this little girl who walked in. So
I couldn't stop watching it. I had to watch it like five to 10 times.
Me too, several times. Okay, so let me set the scene for you if you haven't watched it. It was a BBC interview with this international relations professor, Robert Kelly. He was doing a Skype interview, I think, about South Korea. And what happened was, while he was talking about this very serious subject, the door opened behind him and what initially looked like his office turned out to be his home office. And his little toddler came brazenly dancing in his office. And she was really, really very cute. So
yeah,
when she walked in, I think a few moments later, another toddler walked in with a stroller, a walker, that he also came into the picture. And all this time, while the BBC host is trying to have a conversation with this professor, and he managed to keep his composure, I would have to say. That was very well done. You could see he was freaking out a little bit, but he kept his composure. He didn't get up or break his commentary. However, what happened was that later on, you would see a woman kind of rush in to grab the children out of the room. And the video, it has been viewed hundreds of times now, according to the BBC, to the delight of many hundreds and thousands of people on social media. But what happened was the kind of conversation that started, many people, including media outlets who were reporting on this, assumed that the woman who walked in was the nanny.
Including myself, actually.
She was she's of Asian descent. But she is his wife. So she is Jung Kim, Professor Kelly's wife. And I guess now we want to talk a little bit about how this came to be. You know, the discussion and the assumptions about race, gender, and mixed race couples.
And also the kind of stereotypes that's around Asian spouses, you know, whether they look like maids or they are the spouse. And I think given that we just celebrated International Women's Day last week, this is also a reflection of the flustered reaction by the mother and wife. Is that a reflection of this extreme fear of the head of the house? Right. That those kind of questions come in as well.
So when I first watched this video, I thought I heard the child say "mommy," and that's why I thought the woman was the mom. But on the other hand, the way she was so flustered made me think that, oh, was she worried that her boss might scold her? And that was when I thought,
exactly.
Wait, could she be the nanny instead? So it was kind of like this multifaceted thing when you go, oh, wait, wife? No, wait, nanny. Or is it mommy? Did she say mommy? I wasn't sure. And what happened, in the end, I figured, well, you know, no nanny would kind of yank the child out of the room like that in front of the parents. So I assumed, okay, she must be the mother then.
I think what was going through my head at the time was these sets of instructions being given to the mom and to the wife, saying that he should at no cost be disturbed because he was going to go on this very important interview with the BBC, no less. And when that thing happened, of course, it represented disaster, right?
That's right.
You've broken that rule or the promise not to ruin daddy's interview with the BBC.
Yeah, daddy was trying to be so serious.
Exactly.
And this is the BBC. I thought the BBC presenter handled it quite well because early on he said, oh, it looks like your daughter has joined the conversation, or he said something like that.
Yes.
So, you know, clearly acknowledging that.
He was very cool about it.
Apparently, I have some unverified information that the Professor Kelly was not wearing any pants
so
or was not
get
dressed,
to handle the toddler. I think
what he
could have done was it would have been awesome if he just carried the toddler onto his lap and continue with the interview, and that would have even more made the video even more viral.
I completely agree with you. I wish he had picked her up and just put her on his lap and continued talking about, you know, the politics of South Korea. Imagine that.
Yeah, because we're too serious, right? This world is too serious. And I think that having more of these blurring of lines would make the world a kinder and better place to be in. And it's also going back to why the mom or the wife was so flustered. If the world was a kinder place, she wouldn't have been so intimidated and fearful about what happened. And this also leads to one or two feminist-tinged articles that have appeared as a result of this incident, saying that clearly this reflects that big divide between the importance of a man's work and a woman's work. And both are equally important. So our mistaken stereotypes reflects on us as well.
Wow, imagine that, you know, this video that, you know, this young girl who interrupted her father's Skype interview has now gone on sparking a debate about feminism and gender roles. That's wonderful. Have you ever had anything like that happen to you while you were doing an interview for BFM, Jules?
My interviews are always, unfortunately, too serious. I wish, you know, some toddler or some pet would come up running during the interview.
I have to say, there was one interview I did for the Breakfast Grill many years ago, and I can't remember now who it was, but it was a woman, and I was interviewing her about something really serious when her dog came into the room and started to whine in her phone recorder. And I have to say, that broke all the tension that we were, you know, all the seriousness.
That's wonderful.
So she warmed up significantly after that. A couple of others was a Market Watch interview that was interrupted by the sound of sirens. So that was, you know, that was a live interview where you've got, I think,
yeah,
a cop
the police,
car coming.
The police in the background. It's New York. It's just another day in New York.
Exactly.
I think I was involved in a conference call once, and we were speaking with this analyst who was having his holiday in Malaysia. And in the background were the sounds of these birds chirping. And in fact, a very loud bird sound in the background, you know, and everyone in the room obviously haven't been to somewhere so exotic and tropical as Malaysia, started bursting into laughter and asking the analyst, where exactly are you, you know?
But, you know, that bodes the question now as more people are working from home and, you know, with more work-life balance.
It's a good thing.
It's a good thing. We should embrace little toddlers bursting dancing into Skype interviews. It's something I think is a nice thing to have. We've got the 6:30 news coming up. Lynn Mark is standing by, so stay tuned right here on The Morning Run, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. You're listening to The Morning Run with Julian Ng and me, Melissa Idris, with or without you, by you too. 6:40 right now, and the Harvard Business Review reckons that you'll need two people to run the company. So not just a CEO, but also a chief of staff. So run it like the White House? What do you think, Julian?
I think that the CEO is getting busier and busier. His position is so complex and complicated that it's becoming like that of the president of the United States, right? Where you've got to handle so many things. You've got to handle PR, corporate strategy, dealing with the press, dealing with regulatory institutions, and most of all, dealing with your staff, which is the most important resource of the company. So this article is basically suggesting that perhaps a chief of staff can handle the very sensitive and intricate issue of staff motivation and things like that. I think it's a good idea. It's not a bad idea.
So, okay, so you've got the executive office, you've got the CEO, the chief executive officer, but what this article is saying is that you need to have another chief, a chief of staff for the executive office. Now, I like the idea, but I feel like there's a disparity here. So you've got one guy right at the top. So is this chief of staff, and when I say guy, I'm generalizing men or woman, right? But would the chief of staff be an assistant to the CEO, or is this like an equal in a partnership where it's a co-CEO?
You know, Melissa, we've heard so many times the phrase, usually uttered by people who are too busy, saying that I wish I could split myself into two or three, right? Then I can have two or three of me's running around handling things. I think this is one of those situations where the CEO has split himself a few times. For example, the COO was probably a position created out of the need to handle things in the office, chief operations officer handling the operations in the office, and pretty, in my view, strategic as well, as strategic as the CEO position. And now you have so many chiefs these days. You know, the CTO, of course, extremely popular in this era of tech and fintech, mm-hmm, and so on, mm-hmm, the chief technology officer. Now the chief of staff, I think, equally important, because the role of the employee is changing. We can now work from home. We have these freelance contracts that are emerging as a premier employment contract. I think it's not a case of whether they are equal or not. And I don't believe in that, because this is like a football team, right? Every player is important. For example, if you take the analogy of a football team, the manager or coach of the team is the CEO, and the players are the players. But sometimes the players can get paid more
yes,
than the CEO.
Yes, that's
so
true.
This is about the value of the work that's being done. I think it can be classified as part of the CEO's work, which has become too burdensome, mm-hmm, for the CEO himself or herself to handle.
So the idea of a chief of staff for a company is essentially to... It's a personal one. So the position is going to be you report directly to the CEO. So you allow for the CEO to work on more important things for the company, more big picture things, so strategy and communications. You help the CEO prioritize his or her level of tasks. And one thing that got me thinking about this was I recently spoke to Frank Meehan on The Breakfast Grill. Now, Frank Meehan is a noted tech investor, and he was involved in the early days with Spotify and, mm-hmm, Siri and Skype and Sumly and all these other big tech companies. And I asked him, you know, what is it that you're thinking about when, how do you identify a good tech investment? And he said to me that he always invests in a company that has a co-partner, so two people at the top rather than just one.
Right.
Because he says if he sees a company that's just driven by one person, that for him is a red flag, because A, you know, the top guy could be a megalomaniac or
yeah,
has some
exactly.
personality disorder.
Fast forward to Uber today, because Travis Kalanick is going to look for a parent to keep him in line.
Exactly.
Google
someone
went through,
else to keep him in line.
That's
yeah,
right.
Right.
Google went through a period of growing up as well, with Eric Schmidt coming in to be CEO. And Eric Schmidt is, of course, a couple of generations older than the founders at the time.
So what Frank Meehan said to me was that, having a partner shows that you can work as a team. So you are able to have someone keep you in balance. So there's a check and balance right there. There's someone to tell you when you're doing something wrong or not being the best person you can be. But also at the same time, it's a good buffer, because, for instance, you could get drained being the the CEO, you know, running a company, you have so many challenges, things to look at. So if you are not at your 100%, your partner could provide that buffer or, you know, that extra boost to take on some things that you cannot personally do. So he said, for him, the mark of a great tech investment would be two people right at the top. So a shared partnership.
I agree. And also because today companies are increasingly operating like countries. You know, these companies like Apple, Google, and some of the other tech companies have got revenue the size of a small economy, GDP. So it's extremely complex, the kind of environments they operated in, and therefore they need all the help that they can get.
It's coming up to 6:46 right now. We've got the Beatles for you with Good Day Sunshine right here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.